It's a pleasure to be here and to see that I have both the Prime Minister and Peter Costello's slides before my office. What I'd like to do is lay out the situation in the global labor market that really provides the context for all kinds of decisions that our countries are making with respect to labor issues. Oops. Oh, there we go. Oops. Oops. Okay, it goes to this. Here we go. And I want to talk about, I call it I've changed the title slightly from what was originally given to the CETA. Because this really is, what is the global labor problem? The data on the aging of the baby boomers, which is what raises some people's concerns that there's going to be a shortfall of folks, is... that's U.S. data, but we can get data for other countries. Certainly the U.S. is not the biggest case. The Japanese population has already begun to decline, and we know there are a whole set of European countries where people don't know how to make babies anymore. And, Spain and Italy and Greece... And where either they let immigrants in or else they're clearly going to be a declining trend. And then this was the claim being made in various places is that the labor market is, quote, falling down because of this. And I'm going to argue that that's really not possible given the certainly not for countries like Australia or the U.S., which accept immigrants in large numbers. So these are this is just set it up as a little bit of a battle between two views. One is that this demography is just going to dominate our labor markets, and we've got major problems, and we have to do some training, more immigration, offshoring, a lot. I'll give you some of the quotes from different people analyzing this. And then the part where I'm going to be more favorable to is that with the globalization and the entry of the Chinese and the Indians and the ex-Soviets, we actually have a large number of very good workers whom we can either use, our businesses use either in their countries or bring them to our countries to work. And I've used this term, human resource leapfrogging. It's particularly relevant to China, where they are not accepting that they're going to be making shoes and children's toys ad infinitum, and they have a massive increase in their university population. Current enrollments in China in 2005 will be somewhere around 11 million students enrolled in university. And, give two or three years of that, and we've got the whole Australian population. So this is a significant increase of labor supply for people. Okay. So first let me just give you what was the discussion, in the U.S. at least, of this great labor shortage. And I just hear a number of articles that began. The Hudson Institute is a think tank, and they had what I thought was the key study. They did some projections based on the aging population. There's Time magazine, trying to tell people that even though 2002 was not considered a particularly good year, that it's about to change. The GAO, which is quite a good government organization, government accounting office, there's their statement, National Association of Manufacturers. David Elwood is the dean of the Harvard Business School and was a student of mine and my teaching assistant. And this was a statement came out from Aspen Group. And then somebody in Fortune had a little more sense about this because they realized that most of the American workers were not looking upon this great shortage and seeing that firms were desperately fighting for them and their wages were going up. That was not what's been occurring in the country. And believe it or not, a labor shortage is coming, so they put the believe it or not. This is the kind of information that people were saying about this incredible shortage. And by 2020, 14 million shortfall of skilled workers, and there was even going to be a shortfall of unskilled workers as well. All of this is based upon putting great weight on demography. And it was the aging baby boomers is the heart of the argument. And there's what I thought was going on a bit. I have removed some of the more controversial political statements that the president was making. And I suppose I could tell you what one of them was. It was, John Howard, do you see the weapons of mass destruction? I can't see them now. In any case, the administration bought into this to an incredible extent, to where I was at a conference where the minister, the ministers of labor, but the secretary, labor says our job is not to work for workers. The Ministry of Labor in the U.S. has always been the place that was for the workers' advocate. We have a Department of Commerce that is the business advocate. And hopefully they work together on important things. But generally the one group is supposed to defend more the workers and one is the... And she said, well, we're not going to do anything about workers because the key thing is getting workers for the businesses because of this great shortage. And so there was a transformation. And then you see here the Employment Policy Federation, it's a business group, and they had the forecast up to 35 million shortfall workers by 2030, 10 years later. And then Mr. Collier, who is a consultant and a commentator, he wants more offshoring of American jobs. Well, you can imagine how popular a statement like that is going to be among workers who are frightened of their jobs leaving the country. Because if you believe this shortage to the extent that you believe it, that you know this would make some sense. We got this incredible shortage, and companies are not going to be able to operate because they don't have enough workers, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of this is built on the notion that when an aging baby boomer leaves, somebody replaces that person. And I said it's got to be stable and well-predicted demand. Well, the gentleman on the right has been waiting for a long time, and she hasn't yet left, and she may be living for a long time further. The gentleman in the middle is Cromwell, which just could overturn the entire demand for labor here. I won't give you the statistical calculations I've done on this, but let me just say that replacement demand is not a good way to estimate demand for labor. Usually what happens is, yes, there are a lot of aging people in the United States in some industries. They're in dying industries. It's the new industries that are created. And to base your forecasts on, which is basically what these people were doing, on some old people are going to retire. Yes, there are a set of people in the railroad industry in the United States who are getting old and they're going to leave. Well, we're not going to be replacing them. There's no great demand for young railroad workers in the country. Maybe there should be. Our railroads don't work very well, but that's not there. And you can go industry by industry, and you say, well, where are these replacement demand going to be? It's basically going to be in places where they're not going to replace the people. I don't know how the businesses here do, but when someone in their 50s and 60s leaves, there's usually a very different kind of person nowadays that you might have in your activity, and it's the new businesses. So I just say this is not a very good way to analyze things. Now let me give you the facts for what I believe is the more correct reading of the situation. And I've used the word for this, a great doubling. Which means that if we look globally, not within our countries, where potentially there can be shortages of different things, we have exactly the opposite. These estimates are based upon how many people worked in the advanced countries and the traditional developing countries, LDCs, traditional less developed countries, and then the new guys who came to the global labor market and were not there. And that's China, India, and the ex-Soviets. And 1990, they were not basically there. China was moving in the direction, but we needed a collapse of the Soviet Union to truly open up the markets there. And while I doubt whether too many people here think very much about Polish workers, that's a big thing in the United Kingdom, and that's a big thing for German firms. They're looking more to their you look more towards the Asia, and so does the United States, for that matter. It just happens by chance, the addition of this 1.47 billion people Previously, the statistics were 1.46 billion, so I got nicely said it's a doubling. It amounts to. And the IMF now has a report based on the thing saying, well, it's not really a doubling because what you got to worry about how you treat the peasants versus the people who really are urban workers. And that's sort of true, but of course it's also not true because the minute jobs open up in China, the peasants come running into the cities. And the same thing must be true in India as well. But in any case, it's a huge change in the labor force. And I said it's a labor surplus for the following reason. When these countries joined us, they didn't bring very much useful capital with them. China was, and India both, very poor. Mao had destroyed, masses of things, and the Indian bureaucracy had made sure that lots of things did not work very well. And the Russians, aside from their military technology, when the West Germans went to the East Germany, they found most of the factories were so polluting that you could not conceivably have them operate. And there were some estimates that they're actually, the value added to the economy was negative. I mean, they ran the factory and they used so much energy that had been subsidized by the state. It was bad for the whole rural economy. So here I did was I calculated a global capital labor ratio, taking all of the capital in our countries, adding on the little bit that those guys had, which is basically very, very little, and then made some estimates under different depreciation rates as to what was going on. And if you look, you'll see the under the A or the B projections, doesn't really matter which you choose. Essentially, the global capital labor ratio fell to 55 or so percent of what it would have been had those countries stayed out, because they added huge numbers of workers and they didn't add very much capital. So in a globally capital mobile world, you can see what's happening. The 2000 numbers are higher in part because, of course, everyone is, there's savings, there's global accumulation, and the Chinese are saving at an extraordinary rate. 40% is their estimated savings rate. And so they are actually adding to the world's capital stock essentially almost as much as the Americans are doing with a much higher GDP. So this will change. As time goes on, hopefully the numbers will go up. They must go up. But for the present, you see a situation where the capital labor ratio is much lower. That obviously means workers are in relatively surplus to what they would have been otherwise. And that the business has great opportunities, of course, to locate things in these new countries with these new skilled workers, and all businesses are doing something like that. In the United States debate over NAFTA in the 1990s, the Clinton administration had this very simple message to workers. Don't worry. They're all less educated, less skilled, so they won't compete with you. You just need a high school education or college education nowadays, but if we're talking about actually Mexicans, it turns out a lot of them barely get a grade school education, so even a high school education puts you in a position. They was thinking of the Mexicans. This is not what's happening in the world today. So here I put some enrollment figures through 2002, basically, and I now have them up through 2005. And I would look at the China, which was having basically nobody was enrolled in college and university in 1970. That was because Mao was, destroying everything and having professors like me wear dunce caps and then be sent to live in peasant villages where we're not very good at being peasants. And some of us died at doing that. And it was estimated 12 million. I said 11 million. The numbers are... depends on which sources you do and so on. India has got an increase, so they were close to 10 million. And if you look at Brazil and so on, it's the developing countries that now are beginning to provide, not quite mass higher education the way our countries have, but significant higher education for their people. So the notion that they're not going to compete with us, they will make shoes and we do all the smart work, we know that's no longer true. We can see that in both immigrants and in the offshoring. So that was the story, and that story is not true. Here I just give you a sense of, and this is also a sense of the way the world is, I think, going to be changing substantially. This is PhDs in science and engineering And I do them from foreign universities relative to U.S. universities. I haven't done them for the Australian universities. And the, to me, first surprise was 2001 is the actual numbers, and then there's some projections for 2010 that I would look at. First of all, the EU is producing 54% more PhDs in science and engineering than the Americans. America had this credible dominance because America was the first place that basically did the mass higher education. And then, of course, in the aftermath of World War II, the European universities were destroyed. And it's taken them a bit of time to get back into business. I don't think they're currently the same quality as the American universities, but the quality will be improving. And they're now producing more people than the Americans, and it'll be almost 2-to-1 by 2010. The shock to me when I first saw these statistics, it was at an OECD meeting, and it was for China. It was given out by some members of the Chinese delegation. And I said, this can't be right. You can't be telling me you're going to produce more PhDs in science and engineering in China than in the U.S. in 2010. And yeah, it's going to happen. There's not a question about it. The projections are based on very, because the Chinese government still does play a significant role in lots of things. And they already have the people enrolled. They have the people told, you know, basically, you're going to get a position in the university, in Beijing University or whatever university they're doing. It's quite substantial. And then we also have an extraordinary number of Chinese students getting higher degrees in the U.S., and I know that same thing is true here. So you've got a lot of Chinese people. They'll be staying in our countries, hopefully, but eventually they'll that flow will shift back. So I think we should think about the world labor supply is there's a huge influx of people, and it's going to grow and grow and grow with whatever we think of as the top skills that we may want in things. And we shouldn't think any more that we, the Western advanced countries, are going to have this sort of monopoly on the great skills. Okay, now let me. I'll carry the story a little bit further with our four claims. I want to make sure you go away suspicious of anybody who makes projections based upon demography. In the global world, a demography of a single country, unless you have closed off you're completely from foreign immigrants and foreign trade, is just not a rational way to think about things. And then I've already told you these countries are making this big move to the science technology frontier. And then the surprise that I didn't realize until this summer, when I was doing some work on developing countries, this is the going informal, and which is a message I'm going to be taking to the IMF and World Bank. I'm giving a whole bunch of talks this fall because I don't think they fully recognize the nature, the way in which economic development has changed. And so I'm going to conclude with this thing. We cannot have an actual shortage because we can always bring in very good people from overseas, or we can move some of our business activity to the overseas locations. I mean, IBM has major facilities for research. Microsoft has major facilities for research in Beijing. IBM has made, a $1 billion investment in India. There's just no way IBM is going to have a shortage of people, given that they're going to globally source, and the people are just coming out in large numbers. Here, it's some of the population things that go beyond the U.S. And the place which really the demography hits a lot is West Europe and Japan. I don't have the Australian here. Australia is going to look more like the American thing of continued increases. What this does mean is that the share of workers in currently we think of as the advanced countries is going to become increasingly the U.S., and I could add to that U.S., Canada, it's the new immigrant, our societies. Japan, if these are UN projections, and so they're probably not accurate, in the sense of the Japanese may suddenly decide that they have to have more children. Every talk I give in Europe, I keep saying to the Europeans, you really have got to think about having children. And my own view is actually that is a better cure than Keynesian macroeconomics to causing spending to grow. And it's the individuals making the spending decisions. And the Germans now have picked up a little bit of this message. And there you see... There's a woman minister of family. If anyone has seen, she has like 7 children. She has a PhD, an MD. She holds a zillion jobs, and she wants every German woman to be like her. And that's not possible. It's not possible, for anyone except Superwoman to be like her. But they really are. God, they're building more creches for people. They're really going on a program, and it's both political parties in their coalition to really make it easier for women in the workforce. And then you see there's going to be a change in China because of the one baby policy. They are going to begin declining at a certain point. And India, not having a one baby policy, is going to keep growing, and that's sort of interesting to this. So there are these trends, but I don't think they affect the U.S. I don't think they affect Australia anywhere near. If you're in Japan, I could see you might be worried. And the Japanese don't let in immigrants very much, so it becomes a real concern. And Western Europe, this concern, but because they have Eastern Europe, and that's what they're dealing with now, letting people in. Then it's very important to understand these demographic changes don't determine what happens in the labor market. I sort of tried to show you a little bit of that from the replacement demand. One of the things that most economists expected. When the baby boomers came into the job market, there was a huge drop in the wages of young people, because there were a lot of them, the supply and demand. I wrote a paper on that, and then along with everybody else, expected that when the baby boom generation sort of passed through and we got smaller numbers of young people, their wages would go up. They didn't. They didn't go up in the U.S. They haven't changed very much in any of the countries. And so there is an interesting puzzle there of how come when the supply increased a lot, the wages went down, but when the supply decreased a lot, the wages didn't go up. And for the moment, the various people tell analyses as to why that occurs or has occurred. I don't want to get into that. I just want to say you should be very suspicious of these demographic-based projections. They have not worked out. The end of World War II, the Americans, the big projection was that we were going to have an incredible labor shortage because we thought all the women who worked during World War II were going to go back home. And they didn't. They kept working. And so lo and behold, the American workforce ended up with the soldiers come back and the women are there. We had a bigger workforce. And they just missed the behavior of people, what was going on. And it's so easy, I think, to put faith in these demography, but it's wrong. Oh, well, there's our great doubling coming up. What's happened? Oh, we're going the wrong direction. That must be. What am I doing? Oops, trends. No. Oh, okay. These got somehow or other in there twice. Okay, here we go. I apologize. This is my answer to the shortage thing, which is the global sourcing and Donald Trump, et cetera, telling us you're fired. What's happened in the developing countries is that the surplus that we think of there possibly being of less skilled workers, our expectation was that was going to decline as these countries advanced. And we're going to show you in a minute some statistics that says that hasn't happened. It really stunned me when we put these statistics together this summer. This hasn't happened. They are looking more informal workers than they had 10 or 15 years ago. And we get the trumping of this. This is the U.S. figures. It looks like he's got a little bit out of place. I don't know what happened, but it's okay. Just showing that we are importing large numbers of foreign-born people. The 90s boom in the U.S. was based on bringing in highly skilled foreign immigrants. So our fraction of bachelors who are foreign-born went from 11% to 17%. Today in the U.S., over half of the young PhDs in the country are foreign-born. So I don't know what the Australian figure is, but I'll put any amount of money there in the same ballpark. So no shortage. We just bring the people in because we're wealthy countries and that they can have better lives in our countries. Okay. Got this G. I said this already. Okay, and this is now the thing I said about these countries also developing themselves. This is an index put together by Georgia Tech that shows China. The index compares where you stand in certain, an average of a whole set of indices of technological prowess. So are you exporting high-tech goods? Do you have a lot of scientists and engineers? How much R&D are you doing? And you see in 93, China was at about 43% of the U.S. Now China's up to 70% of the U.S. So by this indicator, they are moving rapidly to the technological frontier. Okay, now I get to the one I thought it was organized a little differently. This is the informalization that I promised you. And I called it a gorilla for obvious reasons. This is the ILO definition of who do we think of as informal workers in the world. Well, they're self-employed. Then there are these wage workers in what are spoken as insecure and unprotected jobs, and household workers. And I say, well, the self-employed is a little bogus because we know that includes a lot of high-paid, highly skilled professionals, and that's not really what we want to think of as informal. We want to think of the informal as the self-employed guy who's selling coat hangers on the streets of in Peru, where you'll get people. And in Latin America, where they've done the most work on this informal markets, they include pretty much anybody working in a small factory who is not covered by social insurance. And that was what I said earlier, those guys. This is what we assumed the world was going to look like. Here I've got GDP per capita, so our countries are all the blue ones at the far end, and then we have the poor developing countries, the ones, and then the red ones are quote recently developed countries. So that's Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong. It includes some of the transition economies as well in Europe, the ones that have been extremely successful, and. There are actually four data points for each country. So isn't that the number of countries in the world grew? We had 4 years of this and put them all together. And what it shows is the fraction informal falls with development. That's what everybody expects in the third world, expected, I would say. That you said, well, if they're going to grow really rapidly, people will get into secure, regular jobs. That's certainly what I would have expected, and what I think the World Bank, the IMF and pretty much everybody. You forget the regression thing here. All that just says is that yeah, that's a good relation, but you can see it. It's a good strong relation. Informal sector has been growing bigger, and these are for the 10 most populous countries in the world. I went and sort of searched. I'll look at line two, and then that's the one that's critical. I was put together these figures thanks to the wonders of the internet, where you can just download. Studies all everywhere in the world of any kind you want. And so I went through this big effort of downloading all these studies and looking at what was the fraction informal in these major developing countries. So this will be two-thirds at least of the developing world. China and India already gets here. And you get Indonesia in there and Brazil. You've got the bulk of the things. Some of the figures are only for urban. Some include rural. And what you'll notice quickly is that every single country, except Indonesia, where it's stable, the informal sector, the informal, what the Indonesians define as informal employment, everywhere else it's growing. So what's happened in the last 15 years is that in all these developing countries, including ones that have great growth rates, the informal sector is definitely not declining as a share of the workforce, and it's rising. The top is a ILO, which just gives you figures for self-employed, and they said that's rising in the world. And that is not independent Western consultants, doing this, or star writers or whatever it is. These are people. It's every single continent we have this. I was really stunned at this. So then what I did was I said, well, let's look at how this connects to GDP. So here, I have the growth of GDP of the countries. And this is only one point for each country. And there I show you the average change in the fraction that's informal. And remember, the relation in the cross section was incredibly downward sloping. This zero correlation is nothing, which of course is what we saw earlier in those country figures, namely that countries that are growing very rapidly are not reducing their share of the informal sector. And that means we're going to be entering a world, as far as I can see, is which countries that grow a lot, be it Indonesia, India, China, they're going to keep having a huge informal sector. And that's a very different vision of the world. Now, what about our countries? Oh, well, first I go to China. I'll do ourselves in a second. These are new figures, just came out the summer from the OECD. They had their own, everybody's got their own estimates of the size of the informal sector. So they're different, slightly different definitions. So their numbers for China was, it was 64% in 1990, and it's 66% now. It goes through a decline, but that's before the Chinese closed down all the big state factories, which they did in the mid-90s, and which were 9 or 10 million people were displaced from those factories. They all go into informal sector jobs, basically. And so you look over the whole period. I would have just said nothing much happening. The rise in the urban sector is a whole lot of the Chinese development. You go to any city, and you go to Beijing or Shanghai, and you see all these people, street vendor types, people, mom and pop stores, etc. Let me just make a comment. I don't think I have a slide for this. Okay, I did that one before I go to my own town. The country that is the most remarkable in this is Korea. Because Korea has been this stunning growth success. In Korea, according to the latest Korean figures, Korea is seeing a rise of the share of the workers in the informal sector. And to me, that was mind-boggling, because Korea, as you may or may not know, has the biggest increase in the college graduate workforce in the world. They have more people going to universities than does the United States or Australia, as a fraction of the young age group. And they're going into an economy where they're rising informal sector stuff, and it's mom and pop kind of retail stores. Japan has had a little bit of that. So this really is something going on very, very peculiar. I suppose if you're a business looking for highly educated people, well, it doesn't look like the domestic economies are going to absorb these people if the informal sector is not the place for them. So they will remain there. This is my own area in Massachusetts, where we now have an informal sector of a major kind that has grown basically from illegal immigrants. These are Brazilians. You drive actually 10 minutes from my house in Brookline, which is an upper class sort of part of Boston that's separate from Boston. And this is Somerville, where the newspaper story is about. But we have one right near my house. We're a shopping mall where every morning, if you go by the shopping mall at 6 o'clock in the morning, there's a lineup of about 100 Brazilian men who are waiting for trucks to come by to hire them as day laborers to do construction in the state. So this is a guy, Luis, who's got some... He's a trained drywaller, and he says he's illegal. Well, we know all these people are illegal, and the police know they're illegal. You know, our country does not want to really do harm to these hardworking people. And when the Bush administration tried to do something against some of the raided a factory in Massachusetts where they were illegal folks, the uproar was immense, and the problems were something like this: they arrested the mom. And we're going to deport her. And she's got an American-born kid, age 6 years old, going to the kindergarten. The kid comes home, and the mom's not there. And you can imagine what the newspaper media does with that. And the Bush administration had to back away from this. And so we know this is the informal sector coming to the advanced capitalist country with an end. My guess is there's millions and millions of people like this throughout the America at this point. You just go to any city, and you can ask, and we never had this. In my life, as a student, the idea that you'd have people lining up at 6 in the morning to get jobs. I don't know what the situation is here. If there's a place in Melbourne where you have something similar. We are almost out of time. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Why has this occurred? And I think there are two possible things. And the one I'm going to stress is that the modern technology has moved so rapidly to these countries that they are producing, the productivity just is zooming in China. They have the same technology as the workers do in the U.S. or Australia or Europe. And, of course, they're paid lower wages, so a lot of money can be made from this. Let me just show you the world manufacturing employment figures. In the world today, manufacturing employment is dropping rapidly as a share of employment. I'm sure it's dropping here. It's certainly dropping in the U.S. Interesting to me was the U.S. drop is no faster than it is throughout the world. So what's going on? Well, if you take China, manufacturing employment in China is falling. It's falling in absolute numbers. Why? Because they got rid of all these inefficient state factories. They open up modern factories with Western businesses, or they're using Western technology, and they're producing lots of goods. But, of course, so this whole sector, which had been the prime thing you thought of for development, you do the manufacturing, you get the formal jobs, it's just not growing. It's certainly declined throughout Latin America. But Latin America, we all thought, okay, it's declining because the Chinese are there and you can't compete with them in low wages. Well, it's every place they're declining. I'll be faster. This was not part of the vision we had of the world. I'll give you some quotes here just from people. Mr. Feenstra is a well-known trade economist. The other people from the IMF. People did not think this kind of stuff was going to go on. So here they thought trade was going to cause a great burst. They're now saying, well, we don't know really what trade is doing. And they thought the free capital flows were going to cause a great burst that we could have in the normal pattern of development. Now they're not sure about that. And so I'd say they eat humble pie. I don't know. Who is Frank Bento? As eaten by the Australian national cricket team. What's that? Do you mean to say you actually lost a cricket match against the British at one point? But what's happened in world thinking is that the IMF and the World Bank, and they had not yet seen the informalization things, but they have just done a backtrack because they know the development is not going the way they expected. And now my message is it's not going the way you expected, not only in these areas, but also in the area that I think is the most important, which is getting jobs for people. It's going different. And you read this. And what I have done in some of my talks here, I read this and I say, it'd be nice if the Australian government also showed some humbleness about their expectations about what certain kinds of changes would do. Because elsewhere in the world where they've done some of these reforms, they now are saying, well, gee, they didn't work the way we expected. They were unrealistic. Any reform goes is not a good idea. Et cetera, et cetera. So I think we were seeing in the global policy community a lot more saying, we don't have all the answers. We better be very careful and proceed slowly or else we could screw things up badly. And that this is the IMF speaking here. And I believe Mr. Wolfenson is an Australian, is he not? And that was him declaring this whole thing has been dead. Everybody knows that these set of policy things that they have been recommending do not work. And I'll now conclude. So what vision does one have of the world from all this? I think we're going to go through a period of about 50 years of bringing these masses of people from China and India and the ex-Soviets into our world to where eventually they're getting reasonable wages like we got, as we have. 50 years is sort of what Korea, from the end of the Korean War, if you take that, and Korea's been an incredible growth success. You do Japan. It's basically that's the time it takes for countries that really get their act all together and do the right things to get to the level of where they're sort of in the same base as that we are. So that's a reasonable thing. There's going to be a lot of pressure on workers, I think, in lots of occupations because these people are getting the skills and they don't have to be paid the wages if you're doing some of the work. And I think businesses, capital is going to be in the driver's seat for a long period. And this does require, I think, a really major rethinking. And business, I think, is going to be in good shape. This shortage thing, bring some guys in from India. Check out the Brazilian universities. There are very, and they all speak English. For us, it's really advantageous. And maybe you want to run a French business, it may upset you a little bit because and there's a set of questions I just give here about it's a transition is never that easy, I think, over the period. And these are so much more people than when Japan joined, you know, began successful, or and Korea was just a small, country, et cetera. And I think this is the real issues we got to, worry about. I put at the bottom environmental disasters, because everything we're talking about here, if there's some major environmental disasters, that will change the whole, calculations, et cetera. This is my view of business community in this process. I said they're doing the Lord's work in the LDCs. Well, they're bringing the modern technology. They're bringing good jobs. They're, in many cases, bringing good labor relations practices. And they are the beacon of light in a lot of these countries. Devils work in the advanced countries because obviously moving those jobs and that technology is harmful to some workers in our countries. That's what they're doing. And I think as countries, we have to figure out a way so the Lord's work gets helped and the devil's work doesn't lead to bad things. And that's the nature, in my view, of what the policy over this period is. And I quoted the head of IBM, who just is so blunt about this. The idea that he is an American corporation, you may have seen the interview in the Financial Times, was last year. He's just, how dare you call him an American corporation? He's global. He doesn't give two tin diddles about America. He'll locate plants in the U.S. if he gets big tax breaks from the things, and that's it. And I see no problem with that in a real sense, because that really is spreading the good things. And then this is the last slide now, finally. I'm not sure what the new policies we do, but I think one thing is, if we're going to be in a period of time when there are lots of workers coming from these developing countries with low wages and good skills, the global policemen, or what do you call the IMF and the World Bank and governments, should think that we don't need to protect capital. Now, that was the view of the 1970s and 1980s. You had to protect capital in these countries because that was the necessary thing. That's not going to be. It's got to be some way of protecting labor in a period until we build up our capital stock. As workers, we all want lots of businesses competing for our skills. And as businesses, we might not like that, but even businesses are made up of people, and as people, we also want that. And that's my conclusion.